You're welcome back. You're listening to The Sunday Show. If there's going to be a war, all of us will be dependent on the reportage of the news correspondents in the field. In the context of Iraq, with massive world opinion opposing the American-led invasion and the enormous risk to millions of civilian Iraqis, the conduct of this war will, we suspect, very soon replace the argument about whether it should take place or not. Here's a moment from the archives to reflect how the BBC once upon a time reported war.
For the first time in the history of Japan, the emperor spoke to the Japanese people over the radio. He said, "We declared war on America and Britain out of our sincere desire to secure Japan's self-preservation and the stabilization of East Asia. It being far from our thought either to infringe upon the sovereignty of other nations or to embark upon territorial aggrandizement." Despite the best that had been done by everyone, the gallant fighting of the military and naval forces, and the devoted service of our 100 million people, the war situation has developed, not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while the general trends of the world have all turned against her interests. The Emperor said that the Allies had begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage was indeed incalculable. It took toll of many innocent lives, and should they continue to fight, it would not only result in the ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, but also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization. Concluding, he said, "Unite your total strength to be devoted to construction for the future. Cultivate ways of rectitude."
Well, that was how it was done, and that's part of a news bulletin from BBC way back in 1945. Now, the first question we were asking this morning is, does Irish public opinion at this moment in time feel they are being told the truth?
So I think if I looked at CNN, I wouldn't believe them, because they are totally American favoured, and so I certainly wouldn't take what they say at all.
The ones I seem to trust are the reporters who are actually on the ground, the guys who are reporting live from Iraq and Baghdad, that you actually get a feel for what they're talking about, you know.
I don't know who I trust, to be honest with you.
Generally the Irish daily papers, the main ones, like the Times, Independent, Examiner, those papers, would trust the print media more than television or radio. Television media has to, I suppose, has a certain time frame in which to give out the information and has to keep people's attention. But the BBC, I think, is pretty good coverage of the issues as well.
I would think the tabloids would definitely blow things out of proportion, so I wouldn't place any trust in them whatsoever. I would be very much for the Irish dailies as well. Trust them.
Get my information from the Irish Times, from the internet, through friends. I watch the news or the RT1 News, watch Channel 4 News. I would not watch CNN or Fox because it's all propaganda. I don't think that the Irish media does justice to what is actually happening. I think that it's certainly still a little bit more convinced by the government and therefore would give more information on the side of Bush.
Well, just a collection there of voices from the streets of Dublin this week. It's not a scientific survey. It's what walked into the path of our roving microphone. Now, an American senator once remarked that in war, the first casualty is usually the truth. And 25 years ago, British journalist Philip Knightley wrote The First Casualty, which has become the great classic history of war corresponding, and their never-ending struggle to separate truth from myth. In the past 150 years, Knightley argues, the military and journalists have been battling for supremacy, and now the military have won. The soldiers' instinct, tell them nothing until the war is over, and then tell them who won, has become the journalistic imperative to reveal as much as possible, as soon as possible. Vietnam, says Knightley, was the zenith, Kosovo the nadir. Philip Knightley joins us, but also joined by Kate Eighty, a distinguished BBC war correspondent, and author of The Kindness of Strangers. And Chris Hedges, a veteran war correspondent for the New York Times, who wrote War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Chris covered war zones from Central America to Iraq, from Sudan to Sarajevo. He's been imprisoned and shot off, unearthed mass graves, and witnessed the effects of torture and death squads on victims of war around the world. And of course, here in Dublin, in studio with us, is former editor of the Irish Times, Conor Brady, who covered the conflict in Zimbabwe. Good morning to all of you. I'm going to start with you, Philip. Has anything changed in the 25 years since you published that book? Just to summarize, you seem to suggest that Vietnam was the last time the military allowed the press to go free.
That's exactly what I suggest, and that's what I still believe. All that's changed is that the military and governments have become much more skilled at managing the media in wartime. I don't diminish the problems that war correspondents face, but I think in this war we're going to get even less than we did before. The distance is huge. Nobody knows where the attack will come from. There's going to be censorship. The Pentagon's adopted the attitude of no more Mr. Nice Guy, report the war our way or not at all. And they've even threatened that they may find it necessary to bomb areas in which war correspondents are attempting to report from the Iraqi side. So it doesn't look good to me.
One got the impression last time out in the Gulf War that most of the correspondents spent the war in five-star hotels in Kuwait, being shown videos at lunchtime by General Schwarzkopf.
Well, I think that was probably, that's partly true. I mean, it's a bit of a slander, but nevertheless, given the choice of going up to the front in a pool system or getting regular briefings from the American military, I think most chose to take regular briefings. And the way that those briefings are run is to snow you with lots and lots of material in which contains very little information.
Now, Kate Ady, you join us from the BBC in London. Thank you very much for going to all this trouble on a Sunday morning to come and join us. I suppose you're watching with a mixture of emotions this war beginning to happen because you're not going to be covering it.
Oh, I will be. And what actually appalls me is the difference between 12 years ago and now. I've seen the complete erosion of any kind of acknowledgement that reporters should be able to report as they witness. The Americans, and I've been talking to the Pentagon, take the attitude which is entirely hostile to the free spread of information. I was told by a senior officer in the Pentagon that if uplinks, that is the television signals out of Baghdad, for example, were detected by any planes, electronic mediums of the military above Baghdad, they'd be fired down on, even if they were journalists. Who cares? They're in Baghdad.
Kate, just to underline that, sorry to interrupt you, just to explain for our listeners, uplinks is where you would have your own satellite telephone method of distributing
the
information.
Telephones and the television signals.
And they'd be fired on.
Yes, they would be targeted down, said this officer.
Extraordinary. And
shamelessly. He said, they know this, they've been warned. This is threatening freedom of information before you even get to a war. The second thing is that there was a massive news blackout imposed in the last Gulf War, where I was one of the pool correspondents with the British Army. We effectively had very, very light touch when it came to any kind of censorship. We were told that anything which was going to endanger troops' lives, which we understood, we shouldn't broadcast. Other than that, we were relatively free, unlike our American colleagues, who immediately left their pool after about 48 hours, having just had enough of it. And this time, the Americans are asking journalists who go with them whether they have feelings against the war. And therefore, if your views are that you are skeptical, then you're not particularly acceptable. Secondly, they're intending to take control of the Americans' technical equipment, those uplinks and satellite phones I was talking about, and control access to the airwaves. And then on top of everything else, there is now the blackout, which was imposed during the last war, at the beginning of the war, was ordered by one Mr. Dick Cheney, who is in charge of this. I am enormously pessimistic of the chance of decent on-the-spot reporting as the war occurs. We will get it later.
You're speaking of your American colleagues now. We've joined Chris Hedges, who, a legendary correspondent of the New York Times, got up very early in the morning to join us. Chris, thank you very much. You're very close to it, and I should imagine the panic about free coverage of the war is greatest in the United States of America.
I wish it was a little greater. I certainly agree with your two colleagues, but I would also, I certainly would want to add that in wartime, usually the press is part of the problem, and that, I think, is illustrated very well in Phillips, as you quite rightly call it, this classic work on war correspondence. And one saw that, especially with the American press during the Persian Gulf War, that it wasn't just the Pentagon that imposed restrictions, but it was the fact that the press was part of the problem. The press, the American press, administered the pool system, which was very restrictive, and the press felt as it feels now, that it was part of the war effort. We see that with these one-week Boy Scout jamboree camps that the Pentagon has set up to sort of...
Yes, Chris, tell us about those.
Well, for those of us, such as myself and Kate, who, you know, covered war zones for quite many, many years, of course, they have nothing to do with what combat is actually like, and that's not really their purpose. Their purpose is, number one, to get the Pentagon or the U.S. military good publicity, and that's working because everybody who goes and, you know, dashes through simulated fire does a nice little stand-up or a piece for their newspaper. But more importantly, it's a way of kind of initiating these reporters into the fraternity, bonding them with the units, making them feel part of
it. It's called embedding, isn't it?
Well, embedding is... That's part of the training program for the embedding. The Pentagon says that it will give slots to 500 journalists. I think what you again have to go back to the Persian Gulf War. The press restrictions were so severe. Let me add that I covered that war, but I did not participate in the pool. I was what they called a unilateral. I went off on my own. But among the American press, you're probably talking a dozen or two dozen people out of the some 800 journalists who actually... decided to defy the Pentagon. And what they do is they rely completely on the military for their logistics, for the decision on what they will cover, for where they will go, where they will be placed, and what they will see. And the military learned from the first war that the restrictions were so severe they couldn't get their own message out. So what we're seeing is a wider dissemination of the news the Pentagon wants you to see.
I'm looking here at a document that came from CNN on the 27th of January. It's called The Reminder of Script Approval Policy. It says all reporters preparing packages must submit the scripts for approval. Packages may not be edited until the scripts are approved. All packages originating outside Washington, Los Angeles, and New York, including all international bureau, must come to ROW, R-O-W, in Atlanta for approval. And ROW is the script editors.
But can I point out that this is a major difference between European and American journalistic practice? That is standard practice with the American networks, this matter of script approval. The correspondent in the field writes the script. It is then immediately transmitted to the headquarters for script approval. It is a system we've never, ever taken up in Europe, neither in UK or anywhere else that I know of. So it's a standard thing. It's not special for war.
Well,
but there will be a script approval of a different sort within that, definitely, within the military.
But yes, I know it's never been adopted in Europe, but Kate Ady, the American programs, and we're watching them now on our cable and satellite television, so in the global world, it's hard to distinguish. We're both getting the same sources, so to speak.
Well, what I think is really a problem now, and I think rightly mentioned by both Philip and Chris, is that things are more sophisticated on the government sides. I had no political interference with us. None of us did in 1990-91. We had nobody other than the military, and the military weren't interested in political matters. They just were interested in precise strategy and tactics in the field. This time, we have already had, from the UK side, I'm not sure about the US, there are representatives of No. 10 Downing Street out in Kuwait directly interfering with the reporting that is going on even before we perhaps commence a war.
Now, Conor Brady, former editor of the Irish Times, is still with us. He covered the conflict in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. One of the arguments, Conor Brady, and you can see the military making, is that thousands of lives are at risk. If reporters are allowed loose, they could cause casualties. They've got to be contained and conducted in a war situation.
Well, I think as the other speakers have been saying, Tom, this struggle has gone on between the military and the media, and undoubtedly the balance has swung enormously in favor of the military. As you say, many years ago I did cover the Rhodesia-Zimbabwe conflict. I have recollections of traveling without letter hindrance throughout all of that war. There was really no attempt. I was quite horrified by what Kate Ady had to say about the intention of the Pentagon to target down people who are uplinking with their sat phones. That is an extraordinary development. It does make it impossible, I would have thought, for any extensive contemporary reporting to take place on the ground. As she says, we may get the truth afterwards.
So, Philip Knightley, I mean, all of this is adding up to the thesis of your book, that we were heading towards complete military censorship, even in a free, democratic Western society.
I'm afraid so, but that's not the attitude of the military. The military say, we're here to win the war, we don't care how we win it, and if you get in our way, we'll bomb you.
I do think there is some kind of division, actually, or let us say diverging, between the US military and the European military. I have done quite a lot of work at NATO over the last few years, and the division between European views of the press and American is considerable, and it comes from the recent history with the American military of Vietnam, Grenada, and also in Somalia. All of which were grim experiences for the American military, and they suffered at the hands of the press. The Europeans have a more upbeat view, and on the military side within NATO in Europe, the French, the British, the Scandinavians are all fairly relaxed. What has happened, though, is that their governments are now interfering. They dislike and suspect military people who speak their minds freely, are quite happy to explain about the military system, but they fear that the overarching political arguments, which is what we're involved in right now, not so much the military. For heaven's sake, the world's biggest nation is going to crush a small Middle East nation with no problem whatsoever, except maybe a bit of collateral damage, which they're not too worried about. But it's the real problem is the political interference, which is now hugely active.
I mean, Chris Hedges, we're watching American television over here. We're watching CNN. We're watching CBS. And we're getting very little impression of the extent to which popular opinion is opposed to the war. And I suppose as the Pentagon heads into this conflict, it is critical that the notion of collateral damage is kept away from popular opinion in America.
Yeah, not only collateral damage, but the press at this point, and I don't think this is particularly something that just the American press does. I think in wartime, this is part of the problem with all national press, is really parroting back the cliches and jargon handed to them by the state. And we are now just being bombarded, as we will throughout the conflict, with this 24-hour news cycle, showdown with Iraq, this kind of stuff, that not only sort of gives the war a kind of inevitability, but robs us of the ability to think about it differently. And that's part of the problem. This sort of mythic perception of war, this flag waving, these heroism, all of it. This has now infected our coverage. But I think that it infects the coverage of most nations that go to war, and I don't think the European nations are exempt.
But also, Chris, you have a particular problem in the United States of America: is that the massive ownership of your media is pro-Israeli and it's pro the war, and alternative voices cannot be heard.
I'm afraid I have to agree with you. Certainly alternative voices are not heard, but you have to remember that I'm not defending it, This is their motive. I mean, it's not political, it's that it's a business. And
would you like to spell out the extent of that to our listeners?
Yeah, there are a handful now of huge corporations that not only control the broadcast media, but frankly control the print media. The New York Times is still owned by a family. It is exempt from that, although even the New York Times is a Fortune 500 or a very large company. But it has been consolidated into the hands of a very small number of people who think about the bottom line. They have turned news into entertainment. It is all about profit, and I'm including the large networks.
And they would be very close to the central group in the White House who are advocating this war, wouldn't they? Or is that?
I can't say that.
Politically.
Probably, but I think you're missing the point a little bit. I think they just know what makes money, and that it's that, and CNN has certainly learned that. I mean, CNN sort of survives from war to war, and as soon as the war starts, they become part of the problem. They're bombastic. They are overtly sentimental, even maudlin, in terms of their patriotism and their support for the effort. And that mythic perception of war, which is really about self-glorification, I mean, that's the sort of flip side of blind patriotism, sells. Well, William Randolph Hearst in the United States built his newspaper empire on this sort of notion of mythic war, of creating war.
Yes, yes.
And I think you have to look at them more as pretty cold-hearted businessmen. No. I don't think there's an ideological motive here.
Now, I want to move on to disinformation and wire services and wire sources. I mean, Conor Brady, you sat in the Irish Times editing a paper for many years, and goodness knows where these sources are that are feeding into Reuters and APP and all of the rest. There's no way of working out how authentic these sources are. I mean, I'm looking at the Sunday Telegraph this morning. There's a story saying the British paratroopers are going to take the main airport in Baghdad. Now, that is a seriously off-the-wall story if it's for real. It's obviously planted by the military. If some journalists put it in, they'd be kicked out. That's disinformation. How do you spot this stuff?
Well, with great difficulty, and one of the real problems which the harvest is now being reaped, if you like, in terms of coverage or something like this, is the huge scaling back in investment in foreign coverage, which characterized the 1990s, of all of the major U.S. networks. When Afghanistan was invaded, I believe there wasn't one single U.S. Television staffer in Afghanistan, and the coverage all came down to a few freelancers who happened to be in there. I think the relationship which we've just touched on there between the news organizations in the United States and the entertainment organizations and the big corporations
and
has
politics.
An awful lot to do
yeah,
with this
yeah.
Because news, every one of the major U.S. networks is now actually owned by an entertainment corporation, and the entertainment corporation is in turn part of a larger conglomerate. The irony of this is that these corporations could, if they wished, exercise huge clout to reverse the policies which are taking place at the moment from government, but they don't.
Now, Philip Knightley, I want to go back to you, because one of the things struck me as quite interesting was, first of all, the size of that massive anti-war demonstration, both in Dublin and especially particularly in London, with nearly 1.5 million people. And one of the things that came through in our coverage was that there was an alternative network information. There was internet, there was text messaging. There's an alternative source of information now available for the first time. Can this deal with the more conventional forms?
Absolutely. I think that's one optimistic note that we can possibly sound in this whole thing. Notice the skepticism of your Vox Pop people.
Yeah.
And the places that they were looking for information. And the view previously held that it was impossible to reach an informed decision about anything. And yet here was this enormous worldwide movement for peace. How did these people get their informed information about what was going on, how to arrange it, where it was going to take place and everything? On the internet. And by word of mouth. And there are messages flying around all the time of people sending each other articles that they feel are important and should be read, making arrangements for various protest meetings, getting together for peace marches and peace vigils. And I think the one thing that might perhaps overthrow the dominance of the media and the spin doctors might be young people, particularly young people, using the internet.
I mean, Alexander Coburn, out of Washington in the United States, runs a website called Counterpunch, which is an alternative view of American politics, and I understand that their hits have multiplied by 25 in the past 2 or 3 months. So that's an indication of what's going on. People are searching for other sources of information.
Yes, I think that's true. And as I say, they're mostly young people because they seem to be more efficient at doing this sort of thing and they're more used to it. And that sense of skepticism of the mainstream media, I think, will grow.
Kate Adie, I want to bring you in because I want to ask you about your personal feelings heading out again, the dangers involved, the difficult relationships you have you have to have by necessity with the troops, the loneliness of being independent to this whole thing.
I think the business of reporting any war is you ask yourself a lot of questions before you even think of going to a war zone, which brings me to another point at the moment. The number of people planned to be embedded, as they say, with the American forces is over 500, and it's rising to 100 with the British. This compares to, I think, numbers of approximately about 90 and 25 last time. The sheer numbers of journalists now who are sent to cover wars. In Kosovo, we had over 3,500 people in Skopje, journalists are to accompany 15,000 troops over the border from Macedonia to Kosovo. An affluent world is producing a huge media, and the competition amongst this media the competition for viewers and also amongst the journalists, and it's been touched upon already, the strength of the entertainment
value
in all of this is now coming to the forefront, and I find it personally very frightening.
Yeah, now Chris Hedges in the United States, I'm looking at these young reporters now reporting the war, and I think that Philip and you and Kate and Connor, you're dinosaurs in suspecting the military are up to something. I see these fresh-faced young people doing these reports from Kuwait, and it's really off-the-wall stuff.
Yes.
They swallowed it hook, line, and sinker.
Yes, but I wouldn't blame it on youth. I think what it is you're getting reporters who fell into line, work in established organizations, don't question the whole corrosion of coverage, certainly in my own country. Because when I covered the war in, for instance, Sarajevo, most of those people were young and most of them were freelancers. They're still out there, but they're not hooked up with institutions. And I think it's important to remember that no war will be covered well or have any kind of real coverage unless we have those independent reporters and camera people who break free from these pool systems and go out and report the truth. But in any war zone, that's only about 10%. And again, I get back to this first point that in most wars, and I think one has to read Philip's book to get this, just how pervasive this has been throughout the history of war coverage, the press is part of the problem. It is not just the military. It is the fact that the press wants to be part of the war effort, wants to do their bit, and that includes disseminating the propaganda that is handed to them.
But another part of the problem, and I put this to all of you, is the culture of popular television as we move towards entertainment and infotainment. And we're now heading towards war programming that is, and I hate to say this, an extension of the entertainment industry, Kate Ady.
Absolutely. I think it's hugely worrying. CNN, I hear privately from people in CNN, they're terrified of the onslaught made on them by Fox Television, a channel which went to Afghanistan with a reporter who waved a gun.
He had his own gun.
He did indeed. And also who lied about where he was and what he had seen. And when exposed by another network, said, well, it made great television. And the other reaction was, and so what? And he did not get in any way discouraged from going on air again. This is the frightening bit. With 24-hour television, what you have now is acres of space to fill speculation, more, as it were, chat, more, less of the concentrated, judged, thoughtful, and sought-out reporting, which takes time and is expensive.
Now, let me put this question to all of you. Do these problems apply equally to television and radio as opposed to the written media? Is there a difference there, Philip Knightley?
I think it applies more to television because, as everybody's agreed now, television war reporting is becoming part of the entertainment channel. Less to radio and probably even less to print media because people have got time for reflection. And you can pick your war correspondent who you trust and who you're likely to believe and rely on him for your main source of information. I mean, I'm going to be looking at the photographs that Donald McCullen is taking. He's already out there again.
He's going back again.
He's back there. The Vietnam veteran is out there in Basra already. I'm going to hope to see something from Peter Arnett, who is back in Baghdad. And I'm going to be watching for all the correspondents who report for the independent newspaper in London.
Connor Brady?
Yes, I think it's time that somebody says something for the newspapers, really, in this. I think this will be a very broadcast-focused discussion, a very disturbing discussion. But by and large, you know, the newspapers did a pretty good job in the first Gulf War, and they were reporting the things which very often television wasn't reporting. A lot of it did come down to freelancers out on the ground managing to get their stuff back. And I would be more optimistic about that in this instance than perhaps one would be with regard to broadcast media. There are other factors as well. As one of your speakers there referred to, there is web technology, internet technology, a lot's going to come out that way. I think we also have to acknowledge that from the Muslim side, there's going to be a lot more coverage now than there was in the Gulf War.
Al Jazeera
is going to be a very important factor in the whole broadcast network. And I think a lot of thoughtful journalists and editors will be logging in to Al Jazeera to get the other side of the story.
And of course, not surprisingly, Al Jazeera was bombed not too long ago. Chris Hedges, Philip Knightley was suggesting to us earlier that this might be the most dangerous war for journalists ever.
Absolutely. I mean, in Afghanistan, don't forget there are 8 war correspondents killed, which on a pro rata basis was more than military people killed. I mean, it's safer now to be in the army and fighting the war than actually being a war correspondent.
Well, I think that Philip's right in that, and if we look at the coverage in Afghanistan when reporters broke free, and I'm thinking of my colleague Doug Strzok of the Washington Post, he was held at gunpoint, threatened with being shot by outside of Kandahar after investigating the killing of civilians by U.S. Special Forces units. So, or he's held by a Special Forces unit. So, I think that what we will see is that as long as everybody, you know, the press is made up of good little boys and girls who go where they're told and report what they're told to report, things will be fine. But those who break free, I think it will be very dangerous. And I think the Pentagon and this administration, which if you go back and look at the rhetoric, the kinds of things they say about the press, has been very dismissive of what they call the liberal media. And those people who try and report not only will be shut down, but I agree, will be in much more danger than before.
We're coming to the end. Briefly, Kate Ady, your plans as you once again pack the old tool bag.
You stay alive to report, and one prays to God that both the politicians who are in charge and the military under their command will have respect for reporters and their right to report freely wherever they are and with whom, whoever they are with.
And a final question for you, Philip Knightley, looking at it from your perspective. Would Blair, will Blair, go to war without the UN if necessary?
I suspect he will. I don't think he has any way out. He's left himself, for reasons that remain absolutely mysterious to me, he's got himself into a position where he'll have to. Otherwise, his political career is over.
A final word, Conor Brady.
Just a huge challenge for the media coming up on a grand scale, and I think probably the integrity and the reputation of the Western free media will stand or fall on what happens over the next 2 to 3 months.
Well, I want to thank all of you, particularly Chris in America, for getting up at ridiculous hours on a Sunday morning. I'm immensely grateful to Kate Ady and Philip Knightley and Chris Hedges. Thank you very much. It's been a most entertaining and informative conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will be suitably impressed. Also to Conor Brady and my other guests today. That's it from the Sunday show.